Coming to you live from downtown Detroit, this is Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep with your host, Joel Elkanen.
This is a volatile puppy here, isn't it?
And Dennis Dick.
I've bitten a penny. I will buy the stock for a penny.
With everything you need to start your trading day.
Welcome, traders and investors, to Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep. Running a little bit slow this morning. We are not going to be having any charts today, so I will do my best to give you a graphical representation of what's going on through my words. So, Dennis, let's get started with the Netflix earnings.
Okay, Netflix earnings here. So yep. We'll just throw big numbers at you there.
Okay,
you
so right. So the story was subscribers, right? They grew by 1.7 million new members in the second quarter, but that was way below the forecast of 2.5 million new members. The money quote, like I just said, we're growing, but not as fast as we would like or have been. And that's the story there, is they weren't growing. Subscribers, big, big miss, and that's it. That's the number.
I mean, we've been skeptical on this show for a long time with Netflix. We've obviously, it's been your underperformer in the big FANG acronym there. But what I've been concerned about and what people are starting to say here now is competition. I mean, I think that's going to be some competition here in the space. And if growth is slowing here, this thing's multiple is scary. And that's why you're seeing the stock down 13 or 14 points here today, down at 86. It did lift off of 82. I was thinking, you know, when it got down to 82, I was like, it could end up hitting that 80 because there's major support at 80. But they're buying ahead of that support. So there is support in the lower 80s here. Joel, technical thoughts.
Well, we cut a big boost off that that top line number. They just took it up. They took it up to 104 and change. And if you'd been paying attention to a previous high that you had at 103.50, you got a pretty good trade off. But that's history now. Pre-market low, it stands at just under $83 here. Pre-market low at 82.26. We got a little bit of a pop. The issue did come down in this this area earlier in the year. I'll just give you a couple levels here. You had a low at 82.91, which coincides with the pre-market low. Another one at 80.55, and then the big number Dennis is talking about, 79.95. That was your low in February. But, man, the way it's just been bouncing off these 82, 83 levels, I don't think we're going to see that area today.
It was right at the lows when Benzinga Pro published some comments from Mark Cuban. Spencer, what was Mark Cuban saying about this?
Yep, we got Mark Cuban over email there. Here is what he said. The biggest threat is a hostile takeover attempt. When asked about the price, he's like, stocks go up and down. Netflix will be fine. They have so many options that are untapped. They continue to dominate the content and consumer delivery for over the top. He compared Netflix to Amazon. So they have multiple untapped levers. He's not worried about, you know, Q over Q fluctuations. He's still bullish on the stock.
So Cuban comes out defending Netflix, and that was right around when it was trading at those lows at 82, 83 bucks. And obviously, you know, saying, I think when he comes out and obviously says something about, you know, a potential hostile takeover there, I think that, you know, coming from Mark Cuban, I think the market does take note. Obviously, you know, Cuban doesn't have any information on this. He's just saying that he sees his value there. He was saying if it's under $40 billion market cap, he's seeing value there. I don't totally agree with this. I think, you know, it's still pretty expensive. You know, could somebody come in and take it over? Yes. But I don't really see that materializing. You know, maybe, you know, under a $30 billion market cap, maybe it becomes more attractive here. I still think it's still expensive to me.
Yeah, I have to agree with that, Dennis, here. And just not getting a big lift out here. But on the other hand, hard to find a resistance when stocks trade like this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And buy the dippers.
Yep.
So am I coming in here shorting it 12 points down? No. buy the dippers. The short was yesterday, or the short was, you know, anytime in the last week here when the stock was approaching the 100. You had a big number there at 100 bucks. It actually got a lift, you know, if you were just checking the after hours chart there. It actually got a little bit of a spike there on the initial report up to 103 or 104.66, and then the bottom just fell out of it here. So it's going to be under pressure here. But I can't say, I don't think it's going to see those lows here today. I don't think we're going back to the low 80s, just because the mentality in this market is to buy the dip, and there's going to be a lot of people licking their chops here on Netflix.
All right. Finding some intraday or pre-market support here just above the $85 level. So for now, keep an eye on 85.11, 85.12. Those were highs back over the last hour.
And you got IBM, which has been really chopping around since their earnings report. Netflix took all the headlines from them, but IBM did report earnings there too last night, just a few minutes after Netflix here. Spencer, you got it, or you want me to jump
into it? Q2 EPS, $2.95. That's 6 cents above the estimate. Revenues at 20.25 billion versus 20.03 billion there. And they also affirmed their fiscal year 2016 adjusted EPS to at least $13.50. So beat on the top, beat on the bottom, affirming guidance.
This was wild after the bell too. So, you know, Netflix was wild, but this had a 10-point range. Initially popped all the way up to 165 bucks. Then it just dropped, and they pulled the rug out from under, and went down to 155.15. So a quiet 10-point drop for nearly no apparent reason. And then they came in, and they just bought it right back up again, all the way back up to 165. So the yo-yo after-hours chart here with IBM, when the dust settles here, and we're looking at it this morning, after quite a few hours of after-hours and pre-market trading here, the stock is trading up $2. So it does look like they're buying it. And I've been making this argument here for a while. I'm going to make it here again, that old-school tech is the new school tech. I mean, you're seeing stocks, you know, like the Netflix that are out of favor here now. And old school tech and Big Blue here definitely qualifies as old school tech. Those stocks, people are buying them. You know, Microsoft, very close to 52-week highs. Intel, right on 52-week highs. Cisco, right near 52-week highs. Applied Materials, right near 52-week highs. AMD kicking around, making new 52-week highs. The old school tech is back.
Right, breaking down the IBM for you, your pre-market high stands at 165.94. Building support at the 160 level. You did have a few dips to the 160 area. This was after hours, but it's been a slow, steady climb here for IBM, trading up 264 at 162.50. Just keep in mind that IBM has not been in the 160 handle since August of last year, when it topped out at 161.85. So you can find some intermediate levels between 165 and 165.89, but that stands as the pre-market high.
What are your thoughts here, Joel, with so much rotation here into these old school tech? Why do you think old school tech is now all of a sudden in the last, you know, basically last couple of months back in favor?
Some of them pay a dividend, and IBM pays a huge dividend, so that's a bonus.
3.45%.
Right, so you're getting paid. You're getting paid to wait. It's kind of like, oh, my God, I just can't keep buying utilities and telecom, right? I have to, you know, have a little diversification. And just, you know, going back to your old standards of investing, you know, PEs and, you know, book value and things like that. Just kind of core investing, I think, is giving these issues a boost.
Yeah, value investing is starting to come a little bit back in favor here. And a lot of these, you know, these tech stocks, these old school tech stocks, trade with multiples significantly less than the overall market here. So, you know, you look at an IBM that's going to project to make $13.50 this year, trading at $162, you know, rough math, that's like a PE of 12 or 13. You know, with the S&P trading upwards of 18 or 19, it looks cheap. And then if you're like, I agree with that argument, that dividend, people want yield, 3.45%, IBM, not bad. Microsoft, 2.67%, not bad. Intel, almost 3%, not bad dividend. Applied Materials, 1.5%. So you see a lot of, you know, there is value there. There's value investors coming into these stocks. And just because the growth, you know, isn't there, doesn't mean that stocks can't catch a bid. And if you look just here, even at Intel, in the last month, I mean, really since the Brexit low, it almost got down to $30. Intel's quietly put on 15% in about 10 trading sessions, 10, 12 trading sessions. It's been a big run for Intel.
Yeah, huge run for Intel, though, Dennis, but you got to be aware of a potential quad top here. Four highs in a basically a dime area between 35.20 and 35.30. Those are the highs of the moves. And then the lows bunching up right just under 35 here. Tight ranges in Intel yesterday. Kind of like tight ranges in the market. Just going back here a little bit. How about since Warren and Carl kind of split ways? This was, back when Carl was dumped his Apple and Warren was buying it from him. The S&Ps were what? A good 70, 80 points lower than we are now. We did have the Brexit, decline, but still well above those levels. Not hearing much from Carl nowadays as the market here bust out the new all-time highs.
Other stocks, there's a lot of reports here. So let's go to the ones from this morning. The big one reporting this morning was Goldman Sachs. GS reported earnings of $3.72. Analyst estimates way down, $3, $7.93 billion versus $7.58 billion. That's a nice beat on the top. That's a nice beat on the bottom for GS here. Stock got a nice lift initially, but you know what? The stock has ran a long ways in 2.5 weeks, and people have turned around and started taking profits on it. And actually, Goldman Sachs is now turned into the red.
Yeah, 65.96. That's your pre-market high, and that was a good level. If you were paying attention to a high that we had just above 166, this was back, that was 167.19. Didn't quite get there. That's a big number on the outside. Barely got into the 66 handle. Didn't even get there. 65.96. High could be in this one. When I look at these things and I look at the charts, I see it's coming from under 140 here. Huge rally. I just don't know. A lot of gap and goes. Look at this, Dennis. One gap and go, two gap and go, three gap and go, then a few days off. I don't know.
It's been running.
Yeah, it's just too hard for me to be buying this thing. If I was a long, I'd be a natural seller. Not sure if I'm looking to go out and short the thing right away. But, man, oh, man. People are sitting on a lot of profits here in Goldman Sachs.
In the last couple of weeks. And that's one concern with the overall market, too, and why, you could see the potential for a stall is that, since Brexit here, anybody who's buying the dip there, they're sitting on a nice windfall because, on every single stock that we bring up, there are a lot of them up 10, 15% here just in 2.5, 3 weeks. So it has been a big run here already. I know we're breaking out and we're at all-time highs, and maybe that's what continues to drive us higher here. But one thing to consider, you can say we've had, a year of consolidation, we were due to break out, but holy cow, we've had a run already.
Yeah, it is. So we'll see what happens. Trying to hold the 162 level, looking at the range from yesterday in Goldman Sachs. Keep eyeing that close. If they can't get this thing back above the close, 163.33, may see some more sellers come into the issue.
J&J reported earnings here just around 6:30 this morning, $1.74 versus $1.68, 18.5 billion versus 18.0 billion. That's being the top, the beat on the bottom. The stock is getting a nice lift. It was up over $4 here, got up to 127.5. Incredible move for J&J. I did sell some stock up there, but the scalper blood may have already covered it. Should have held on though, Joel, because this thing continues to leak here in the pre-market. It's now trading on the 125 handle. And you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to say this thing may not even open over 125 because it's leaking right now, and I think the leak might continue.
Yeah, this is a definitely historical move here for J&J. When we talked about it on the pre-market show, we were posturing that it might not open over 126.
I'm lowering that target. I'm saying it might not open over 125.
Oh, boy.
I don't think no way it's opening over 126, but I don't even know if it's going to open over 125. It's trading 125.60. And you know why we say that if you listen to the show? It's the orders in the book. The book is always thicker there. If I go to the J&J book, it's hard to see up that many levels there, but I'll see what I can see there. And I can see multiple orders there. Well, around 124, 125, there was some size. So 126, I would imagine, has some size. As you get through whole numbers, as stocks are making all-time highs, especially stocks like a Johnson & Johnson, there's institutional money managers that say, look, we're going to lighten up here a little bit because Johnson & Johnson's been on an incredible run here too. In 2016, this is one of your best performers. Stock started the year way down here at about $100. So now you're at 123 on a stock that really isn't growing much either. It's more of a defensive stock. You get this big lift here on an okay earnings report up to 127.5. is institutional money managers that are just booking profits.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, how many times have you seen J&J make over a 2 or 3 point move, yeah, on earnings? I mean,
rare.
Yeah, not much is drug, you know. I mean, they're kind of drug related, but they're not, you know, they're more, you know, selling that No More Tears shampoo and selling those those durable. Do you use that on Spencer, or do you guys use something else?
I don't know which one we use. It's one of them. I don't know if it's the Johnson & Johnson one, but it's one of the baby shampoos. So it probably is. No More Tears.
Yeah, so, I mean, just 160,000 shares are traded, taking it up quite a bit. I mean, if you look at, like, your standard deviations for a move in Johnson & Johnson, I mean, this is just really
usually
out of the norm.
It's a buck or two on earnings. A $4 move on earnings just seems out of the norm for it. And so now it's starting to look a little bit more reasonable, trading up $2 or $2.50 on earnings. Up $4.50, that's why I shorted it this morning. It just seems like too much for a stock like J&J.
Okay. All right. Let's move
on. Lockheed Martin earnings, UNH earnings, Philip Morris earnings, EMC, Yahoo last night. So many earnings reports here. We can't get them to them all. So, chat, if you want us to dive into a specific earnings report, let us know, and we'll try to dive into them. Again, we apologize for the chart difficulty here. Again, I'm blaming Trump or Melina Trump there for this here this morning. Did she plagiarize that speech?
I don't know, but I do want to mention while you're on earnings. We did this yesterday. We're going to do it again today. Joel and I did a Facebook Live at 4 o'clock at the close for about 15.
How do we watch that?
You go on the...
I don't go on Facebook. How else can I watch that?
I mean, I'll post the link in the chat for you, but it's a link to the...
If I grab the link in the chat, it'll automatically take me there, but I have to have a Facebook account.
Yeah.
I do have a Facebook account. All right, so if I click that link in your chat,
yeah,
then it'll take me right automatically to this Facebook Live show.
Yeah, it's on the Benzinga Facebook page. And it's Joel and I sitting at our desk, and we have charts for that as well. So we have charts. We have Joel.
We'll have charts today.
Yes, yes.
And tomorrow.
We'll have charts for that. We'll have Joel and I on camera, and we'll have Benzinga Pro, and we go back and forth, and we kind of walk, you know, do a little live as the earnings come in. Do a little live show. So nothing crazy, only about 15-20 minutes. But it was fun yesterday. We're gonna do it again today. So
yeah,
keep
Periscope it too. That's something else we could do. We never talked about.
Well, it's the same thing, right? We could.
Well, yeah, I'm on Twitter more than I'm on Facebook.
Well, okay. Well, then I'll put it on Twitter too.
That's a great suggestion from Joe Tape Reader. Periscoping it. I like that idea too.
Okay. Noted.
So if you Periscope it too, then I don't have to go on Facebook.
So difficult. Okay.
I'm difficult to deal with. And I still want to talk about Melina Trump, because that's what's flying around on my Twitter stream here this morning, is that she plagiarized the speech. I mean, does she have to hire a new speechwriter? What do you think about this, Spencer?
She didn't plagiarize. Whoever wrote that thing plagiarized it. Whether they did it knowingly or not, I mean, it's hard to believe they did it unknowingly, but I just think it's just when you think it couldn't get more ridiculous, it does. I don't.
So if you're just waking up here right now, what exactly, like, how much of her speech was taken from Michelle Obama?
It was just like a section. It was like a 3-minute section, I want to say.
3 minutes? That's a long time. It's not like a line.
Or 2 minutes. It wasn't like the whole thing, but it wasn't like a sentence either. It was like a section about like family values and it looks
pretty much the same.
Yeah, it looks the same.
And you were saying maybe the speechwriter sabotaged them.
Yeah, maybe I heard a rumor. I don't know if this is true or not. I heard a rumor that they hired a former Clinton speechwriter. But I don't know if that's true. So
the Democrats are. They snuck one in there. They snuck the Democratic speechwriter in there to write a speech for the Republican.
I think more than anything, it just speaks to the incompetency of this campaign and just the sheer the sheer ridiculousness of everything about it. Like, this isn't even the worst thing
that
they've
really
done.
That's really bad. Like, I mean, if, you know, it's like word for word, which Syed is saying here in the chat. Bob Wire is saying two paragraphs are exactly like Obama's. That's bad, man.
Yeah. Well,
Joel, thoughts, concerns? What are you thinking here?
This is Ben Zinger's pre-market prep show.
Thank you.
All right, PNC.
You don't want to get into that.
No, I don't.
I'm sure it's like you were talking about Melina Obama. I'm calling her Melina Trump. That was a Freudian slip there.
I just very worried about this election, Dennis, and I try not to think about it. So I just
you don't want either candidate.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh,
here's the problem. You know, and we got 2 minutes here, and we're going to jump back into the stock chart with Nick Shaheen in 2 minutes. But I just want to say, here is the problem where I am torn here, because I don't really want to go for Trump, but I definitely don't want Hillary, because Hillary has the financial transaction tax in her platform.
Yeah, I agree.
That's trying to put me out of business. I mean, financial transaction tax, she wants to tax your stock trades. So I'm not voting for Hillary if she's going to tax my stock trades. That's literally going to, you know, hurt everyone. So I'm kind of stuck voting for Trump here, so I don't even care what he really does here. Hillary has that financial transaction tax in her platform. I'm not voting for her.
Okay, Dennis, you're worried about your pocketbook, and I'm worried about the worldwide peace. So, you know, we gotta ferret out.
Worried about my job.
All right. Let's go to PMC here.
Financial transaction tax. That is scary stuff right there.
Any thoughts on PMC? It seems like this one could good hit if people start to take profits in the financials today. Goldman Sachs, he's talking about. BAC between the few that had a bought that was bought after earnings. I have to agree with it on that one. Bank of America was one of them that ran after the earnings. PNC, I tell you what I don't like about this stock is it had that pump up over $85, and now you had a tight range yesterday. Four lows right in this 81.50, 81.60 area. C. Gomez, keep an eye on that. Let's call it 81.50. Below that, you do have some substantial downside into the lower or the middle 80 handle, and then under $79 on that. So, man, just don't like the way that chart's looking.
Buy the dip market though here, so I don't hate it as much as you, just because I had the big lift. I mean, again, you're right. If it takes out yesterday's low, that little double bottom, it does have some air below there, but this market here is just resilient, and they look at stocks like that and they say, oh, it's a financial that actually is trading down nearer to the lows than some of the other ones, and people come in and buy it just for that reason.
All right. So 82.09 was a close, not making much of a movement here in PNC.
835. I'm going to call Nick.
They're all scared of what I'm going to say next.
Yeah, that's right. Spencer's like,
I'm not allowed to talk with the speech.
Yeah, you're Canadian, man. What do you care? You got Trudeau.
I told you I care. Because if Hillary gets in, I'm going to have the financial transaction tax. And I got to ask Nick. You know, and Nick, how's it going this morning?
I'm good. I'm not a tax expert. Don't ask me that.
I'm not asking you tax, but I'm just saying Hillary's platform has that financial transaction tax in there. And she wants to tax her stock trades. Does that make you want to vote for her?
Heck no.
So Ecograph is saying, well, you got to be, you know, you go for world peace and don't be selfish about your job there. But at the same time, I got to make a living here. They start taxing my stock trades. I make a lot of trades. I want to pay a lot of money.
Yeah, the only way I vote is with my pocket. So
yeah, I can't vote. Like they say, I'm Canadian. So you got to vote double for me, Nick. And I'm voting against Hillary. So I don't care who the other candidate is. But she has that in there. I'm not voting for her just because I don't want my stock trades taxed.
Yeah, I want to vote for the third guy or girl. I don't see any. So.
I don't know if it's an option, but
yeah, it's not an option, unfortunately. So it's going to be a tricky one for the U.S. this time around.
Okay, let's jump into the stocks then, Nick, here. We've seen this rotation here. We were talking on Twitter last night. You're seeing old school tech is kind of the new school tech. Netflix here getting hit. IBM up. Cats and dogs playing together. What's next?
It's bizarre world, I'm telling you. It's what I call a Costanza market. Whatever you think is right, just go with the opposite, because it's probably going to happen. What's next? I don't know. I mean, there are so many broken things that usually happen that are not happening, and people are buying just every dip. Every bad piece of bad news is being bought fiercely. So it's like they have no alternative out there, and they're just piling money into the U.S. market and bonds. So it's pretty strange to see stocks at all-time highs, bonds at all-time highs, gold's high. You know, people are just buying everything except for the VIX, you know, the Rodney Dangerfield of everything. There's no worry out there, apparently. It's 12.50 back on the VIX. So yesterday I bought some just because it's like on sale. I don't need it now, but it's on sale. Might as well pick up some.
Okay, Nick, so let's just jump in here to the Netflix report here and look at that stock, because it really got hit here after hours. bounced off the 82 area last night, trading up here at 86. What are your technical thoughts here? I know you probably got a chart in your back pocket, and unfortunately our charts aren't working on the show at this point, so we won't be able to show up. Anybody clicking your link will be able to see the chart. So if you're in the chat, if Nick does have a Netflix chart.
Of course I do.
Okay, I know you do. You always got them in your back pocket there. So there's a chart for you guys. Click Nick's link and you can see the Netflix chart. What's the technical saying?
Well, it was into like a couple of candles into some sort of a breakout that had promise. But of course, I told everybody that I know that I wouldn't buy that breakout. And if it does happen, I would definitely short it. I've shorted it several times successfully because on a fundamental basis, it's got issues. Mainly the competition from Amazon, every giant media company, maybe Google and Disney even, anybody that can do media is a competitor to Netflix. And they were the only game in town, but I don't see big reasons why the big guys can't come in and, you know, cause its P&L to be stressed. And, you know, when you hinge everything, it's kind of like Chipotle was hinged on comp sales. This one was hinged on how many signups they can have, and then the churn issue came up. And you can't maintain this at the level they were without having some hiccups. Not to say that they can't go back to it. It's just hard. So technically, it was looking frisky, and whoever chased it is going to be losing money this morning. Fundamentally, it's got issues, and it's got difficulties ahead. So I would not go long it fundamentally. Now, for a trade, I've heard a lot of experts say, buy it. It's bounced so many times down here. But one of these times may or may not stick. But if you want to chase it, I would do it via credit put spreads, which is a bullish trade, but it gives you some room to go. So I wouldn't have faith to buy the stock.
What about okay, I'll let you go, Joel.
Nick,
thought you were sleeping over there.
No. Ed Parker is saying, Nick, how do you buy the VIX? How do you execute that trade?
You just buy the VIX. You click on VIX and you buy.
You don't do anything with the options on it?
Yeah, I bought calls in the VIX, and it's a matter of choosing where and when. And this is where there's no science, because the VIX kind of spikes on potential disasters. So I bought out in time. You know, you can choose August, September, give it how many days. If you think we're going to have an issue of sorts between now and, say, 30 days, you would go with the August. If you think you need more time, you go with September. And you buy calls in the VIX. And if something bad happens of any sorts and the VIX spikes, you may be able to profit from it. But recently, it's been so hard to do that. I don't usually do that. And yesterday, I don't know what possessed me. I just threw a few bucks at it. And it's just, you know, something that they say protection. For me, if I'm long stocks, I would rather buy puts in the indices and ETFs. I think it's better protection directly against my stock, especially in this market where the VIX can't seem. I mean, I've seen days where we had, I think the Monday after Brexit, when markets were down another 300 points on the Dow, the VIX was red. And then days when we had green markets, the VIX was green. So weird things going on with the VIX, so I'm not sure they're broken tool or just a dislocation in the markets all around that's causing it. So it's hard to game it. So if you're trying to protect a portfolio, I would do it via buying straight puts.
All right, Nick, moving on here. Old School Tech, as Dennis mentioned at the top of the show, IBM comes out with a good report. Traded up 216, traded higher in the pre-market session. I mean, yeah, it's a good report here, but man, look where the stock is coming from. If you're afraid of heights, it may not exactly be a buy. What's your technical thoughts on IBM?
Technically, it's an impressive move after market. I think it was up 3% at one point, an initial reaction, and then it was down to flattish, and then now it's up like 1.something%. So it's... I see this technically okay. I mean, there are levels where it broke from descending, you know, lower high trends that were broken upwards. So that's usually bullish, and I'll throw a chart in there for in a second. But I'm still not a believer. I know you said Dennis went back and forth with me yesterday on Twitter that it was old tech back in style. But I'm not sure I buy into this, you know, artificial intelligence as a main, you know, money maker for the company yet. It's been around for a long time. They've been promising it. But technically, you can see how it went through a couple of step-ups, and it has another one just ahead here. It depends where it opens and where it closes today. So potentially, it could find itself closer to 180, maybe 185, based on pure technicals. But fundamentally, I can't chase it from 120 up to here and then higher. Again, if I want to do it, I would probably want to do it in a safe way, maybe a long-distance credit put spread, which is also bullish, but I don't like to chase credit put spreads after such a rip, because I'm just selling it at a discount. So if I'm bearish, maybe I'll do a credit call spread higher also safely, or at least maybe an iron condor on it to try to range it between 150 and 180 for the next 3 months or so, to try to generate income from that. But fundamentally, I'm just not behind it. Technically, it looks pretty good so far, but the market in general looks pretty good so far. I mean, you could put up brackets and say insert stock symbol here and everything will be up, basically.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's
so
true. Everything yeah. moved up since Brexit. I look yeah. at every single chart, they all look the same. They're all up like 10% in a week and a half. And it's even, you know, defensive stocks. Like, you would think, you know, with the market rallying as much as it was, you would see like some of the gold stocks, you know, maybe some of the miners weaker, or you'd see some of the utility stocks weaker. Those are all up too. They just came after Brexit and they bought everything.
We should all agree that there's something going on that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And the experts should agree and stop opining like they know exactly what's going on. Everybody that speaks makes sense, and that's wrong. Because if you think that everybody's right, then that's wrong. It's just by definition, we can't all be right. There are some things going on that we don't know about. It's like defensive is working, high yielding is working, gold's working, the TLT is working, bonds basically working, the stock market is working, and Yellen won't get us off the juice. So yay, party for everybody. I mean, how is this correct? I just don't get it. There's something, we're missing a piece of the puzzle. And until that happens, I'm not changing my opinion that we don't belong up here. And if we do, we don't belong at zero rates or close to it. So something's got to give. We had a blind side with Brexit, we bought it. We had a blind side with Turkey, we bought it in 10 minutes. So the minus 0.1% is the new crash, basically. And then they're buying it and then going higher. So there's something going on that we don't understand. And if I don't understand it, I can't invest heavy because I just don't get it. And I'm missing a piece of the puzzle. So meanwhile, I'll just trade a little bit. And until we get some clarity as to what's going on, and where we're headed, and then maybe we can allocate some more money. But people say, you know, everybody's got cash on the sideline, and I'm not sure how that is bullish or bearish at this point. So there's so much that's going on that we don't know about.
All right, Nick, let's you mentioned gold there in passing, and we were going back and forth yesterday. Just looking at it technically, I see a really, really tight formation here. Several lows bunching up here at the 1320 level. 1320, 40, 2260, 23.5, and today's current low is 2580. And then really over the last 3 or 4 days, you haven't been able to get out of like $15, $20 range here. And I talked to you, it's like, it's going to move, and it's going to make a big move here. And we went back and forth a couple strategies. If you see a consolidation, and we'll use the gold as an example here and maybe equate this to the GLD, what would be the best kind of strategy so you don't, you know, you don't pay up to the premium gods, but, you know, you're able to take advantage of the, you know, of gold or the GLD if it makes a really substantial move from this area?
So if I were to wanted to go long gold, so buying calls would be a way of going long gold, or a call spread to lower my entry price. But when I do a call spread, it's a debit spread, so money comes out of my pocket to open the trade, and that would be the maximum I can lose. If I do it a dollar wide and I pay 20 cents for that spread, the maximum I can gain is 80 cents, which is pretty nice given I only invested 20 cents, if I'm right. Price needs to rise through both legs for me to profit, but I still have to outlay money out of my pocket. Now, in some instances where I believe in the ticker, and if I believe that gold is not going to fall below a certain point, I not only buy those call spreads, but I finance them by selling credit put spread, which is also bullish. So the net effect would be close to zero. And if gold rises, I'm in the money. But if gold, the GLD falls below my credit plus spread, then I'm open to losing some money there. But meanwhile, I'm long GLD for free.
Nick, what about the financials here? Just jumping over sectors here, unless you were going to continue. Did you have a question on the gold, Joel?
Yeah, no, I was just, you know, didn't want to be so much directional. I just wanted to be in it, you know, for a $30, $40 move each way with limited exposure.
Okay, $30 move each way, then I would go long in time. So if I can go to, say, December or January, I can sell an iron condor that's wider than the range I think gold is going to go in it. And if you believe you can want to take a, then you have, you generate potential income in order to buy whichever direction you want to go with. So I'm not sure if that answers. If you're trying to buy to straddle or strangle, you can do it that way.
Okay.
Then I buy to strangle, but I sell a wider, longer strangle within ranges that I'm comfortable with where it's not going to breach. So the trick is, Joel, to find a range where price is not going to breach and sell it to generate the income and then buy the range that you think is going to be breached. So you profit on the debits and you did it for free.
Sure. So just looking here, moving on the sector there, I wanted to ask you about Goldman Sachs. We had a good pop in here this morning. What do you think on the financials overall? I mean, nothing has bounced back harder since Brexit than the banks. If we look, Citigroup's up basically 20% since Brexit. JP Morgan's up a good 10, 12%, a little lower beta there. But Goldman's had an incredible run too. It's trading up almost 20% since its Brexit low here. Do you think the pullback now in Goldman, because it was a pretty good earnings report here this morning, but we're seeing the stock trade in the red. Do you think it's just a little bit of profit taking, and is that concerning?
I think it's issues from the European banks. If I'm, you know, I think 3.5 on DB, Deutsche Bank, and CS, Credit Suisse. If I'm looking at, I think they were down, so it's probably spilling over to us. There were some issues with the Italian banks being rejected, something they were trying to do, a bailout of sorts, and it was voted down by the EU. So that might be spilling into here. Having said that, I've said for a long time that XLF above 2330 to 2350 should not be chased for as long as I'm seeing what I'm seeing in the open interest, and it's been steady. So it has resistance anytime they get into here. It has been, like you said, an impressive bounce off the Brexit, but it was also a huge drubbing. I just posted a daily chart in there. You can see what a V it was. I mean, they just fell off a cliff into the Brexit thing. Because of a combination of that and worries from the European banks. So I don't know if I would, you know, if you ignore the V, they didn't do much. So, but technically, they could break out, but I still see resistance from the open interest. So they would be the last sector I would chase. They're almost a lose-lose situation, because if indeed the Fed raises rates. I know it's crazy. Yeah, I'll wash my mouth out with soap. If indeed the Fed raises rates, then they might spike a little bit. But if markets fall, they're going to turn around and fall with the markets. In other words, they're not going to rally all by themselves. And if the markets are toppy because of all-time highs, then they're toppy too. So they're the last sector I would buy. Right now, I would concentrate on the mega cap earnings that are coming, like Google, Facebook, etc.
Couple symbols from the chat here. Earlier today, we had Syed. He wanted to know about a small penny stock, HDSN. I just want to get your thoughts in general, maybe on stocks like this. The stock this morning here closed at 379. It's your big mover of the day. It's trading up at 520 here this morning, cool. Up 37%. When you have something like this, you know, happen for you, what do? Do you book the profits right away? What happens when you get up 37% of stock, Nick?
Congratulations if you're holding it, first of all.
Yeah.
I would, at any time asking myself about booking profits or not, I always book it. Because I'd rather miss out on a few pennies than to have to say, oh my gosh, I had it and I lost it. It was looking frisky. I've never looked at this obviously before, but yeah, it was looking like a cup and handle, inverse head and shoulders, whatever you wanted. It had a dip and then a shallower dip coming back to the neckline. And if you eyeball it, you know, $5 is probably the target and then some, but it must have had a headline of sorts. So especially with penny stocks.
They got a contract or something.
Here's the thing. I don't know if it has options or not, I can book it and rebuy it or buy calls cheaply into it. Anytime I have, like if I'm holding Google and Google spiked, I would replace the stock with cheaper calls. Book the profits, you know you have it in your pocket with a couple extra dollars. With the profits, you buy some calls. You're still long the stock. What's there to lose?
Dr. J in the chat was asking about two stocks that had earnings reports here this morning, Philip Morris and UNH. PM missed $1.15 versus $1.26.6 billion versus $6.77 billion. So they missed on the top, they missed on the bottom. Stocks trading down $2. UNH actually beat on the top and they beat on the bottom. The guidance was a little bit light here, though, and that's why they're hitting UNH a little bit. It's trading down just slightly here in the pre-market. What are your thoughts on these two stocks?
Yeah, Philip Morris is on a rocket ship. And if we're talking about booking profits, if you don't book profits, then you go into earnings with profits on such a rip unprotected, then you are investing recklessly, in my opinion, or at least not according to my preference of the way. So a little pullback is probably healthy for Philip Morris, but this is an incredible uptrend. I just posted a chart. So I'm not sure where it goes from here. You know, fundamentally, it's probably a solid company, but you know, some people have issues with it. Technically, it looks pretty strong, and they're buying every dip. Same comments on UNH. However, it has, you know, some things I don't know about. I don't know how it goes into biotech, that whole sector, UNH. So Hillary issues, not sure about that. So I'll be a little nervous there. And maybe I would carry some put protection if I'm holding the stock into the elections, just in case. So that would be my thoughts on United Healthcare. It's an incredible rise on top of an incredible rise. So it had a run on a 5-year chart, and then it had a consolidation period and another run. So it's this last run was based on a solid base. So.
Nick, if you get a chance, Elizabeth is asking for a snapshot of what you're talking about with the Iron Condor for gold, if you get a chance to throw that in there. I know you're busy, Nick, and I know you want to go out and catch some Pokemon, but before you do that, I was just wondering if you could give us your comments on Nintendo here. Nice run up here in the issue. Any thoughts on Nintendo? NTDOY.
Wow, you know, it's I'm not one to chase one fad. I mean, just last night at 11 o'clock, I was picking my son up and we were driving home, and there were two young people on a bicycle doing Nintendo out in the streets. I mean, they were too young to be out at that hour, in my opinion, but here they are hunting Nintendo. So powerful move. If you're riding the stock and you're not booking some profits or protecting yourselves, I think it's pretty insane. But the opportunity is it's pretty good. I mean, that was a smart move. Get people out. And then I heard that they're selling whatever these people are collecting to merchants. So if a merchant advertises they have whatever they're hunting, credits in that store, they tend to go there. So I'm thinking surfing companies, sporting goods, restaurants, burritos. You know, I'm surprised CMG hasn't done anything like that. So it's an opportunity for sure. And it's it probably has legs the way it's done, because I think parents would rather their kids out hunt something while using the electronics versus sit on a couch and be sedentary. So not a bad idea there. But from stock perspective, I would book profits and replace with cheaper risk, or protect myself with some, I don't know if it trades with puts or anything. I've never looked at it before. So you would want to book some profits somehow after such a meteoric rise.
All right. We've been on the line with Nick Shaheen. He's an options expert. He joins the show every Tuesday to discuss this week's options outlook. Also a MarketFi maven and the author of Create Income with Option Spreads. Nick, great information as always. Have a great day. I hope you catch a few Pokemon, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks. Can't wait.
All right, Dennis, any imbalances?
Yeah, we got a lot of imbalances here, and actually most of them are to the sell side here today, and some of them are substantial. Bank of America, 402,000 a sell. General Electric, 210,000 a sell. Baba, 56,000 a sell. Twitter, 31,000 a sell. ExxonMobil, 42,000 a sell. Conagra Foods, 53,000 a sell. Usually see the food go in the opposite direction. Pfizer, 38,000 a sell. AT&T, 38,000 a sell. MO, 39,000 a sell, which isn't surprising with Philip Morris. But I'm almost seeing all of them to the sell side, very few to the buy side here, which makes me think, you know, that, hey, there might be a little bit of a weak open. I mean, we are down 4 or 5 handles in the S&P. It just looks the imbalance is a little bit weaker than that.
All right. It is now 8:57. It's time to go to Spencer with some morning headlines.
Real quick, going to mention Benzinga Pro. It is Benzinga's premier newswire platform with real-time breaking headlines and stories. Everything on Benzinga.com is on Benzinga Pro first to get your news feed, your analyst ratings, your audio squawk, SEC filings, or calendar widgets, all that is in Pro. Check it out for free for 2 weeks by going to pro.benzinga.com. Also, you should get Benzinga's Market in 5 Minutes, a daily email newsletter straight to your inbox with all the market news in one place. Today it was in my inbox at like 7:50, I want to say, somewhere around before the show started. So early morning stuff gets you caught up on everything you missed overnight. So you can get that by emailing minutes@benzinga.com. Time for I'm going to take a quick break now. I'm going to grab our second guest. He's Andrew Horowitz. He is a portfolio manager at Horowitz and Company. So we'll be right back with Andrew.
Whether you're a short-term swing trader or a long-term investor, you need to check out Thinkorswim, brought to you by TD Ameritrade. There's a reason why Thinkorswim has been named the number one trading platform, because it has it all. With Thinkorswim, you can trade stocks, options, futures, Forex, and virtually every other type of order. Get notifications on mobile devices and interact with other traders in chat rooms. You can also use technical indicators and see the latest investing and trading education in Think Money magazine. If you want to keep up with the markets, you need Thinkorswim. To experience everything Thinkorswim has to offer, open a TD Ameritrade account today. Thinkorswim, the online trading platform for traders and investors. TD Ameritrade, member SIPC. All investing involves risks.
Welcome back, traders and investors, to Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep, brought to you by Benzinga Pro. I'm your co-host, Joel Alcon, along with Spencer Israel and Dylan Wittenberg. We have Andrew Horowitz on the line. He's the CPF of Horowitz & Company. Andrew, how you doing on this Tuesday morning?
Great, Joel. Thanks. How are you, buddy?
Good. We're doing good here in the Motor City. Tell us about Horowitz & Company, how it got started, and what you do for them.
All right. Well, Horowitz Company, we got started back in, the late 80s as a money management firm. Back then, doing a little bit more traditional type of money management. And over the years, evolved into having several different strategies for people where we have your traditional global allocations based on some very important economic and our internal outlooks. So we kind of model portfolios that way. Plus, we also have some strategies that are more aggressive algorithmic strategies as well as trading strategies for clients. We have a couple of podcasts that we do each and every week, DH Unplugged on Tuesday nights with John C. Dvorak, and also The Disciplined Investor, where we have a lot of great guests on. As a matter of fact, coming up this week, Dr. Daniel Crosby is going to be our guest this week. So kind of a lot of things going on.
All right. So we had a big geopolitical event with the Brexit. Market kind of ran it up ahead of it, thinking they were going to stay. Big disappointment. They crushed the market. Everyone was waiting for the bottom of the trading range to come in. And all of a sudden, we've had this snapback rally from you know where. So discuss why or some of the reasons the market moved up so sharply after the Brexit.
You know, it's very interesting. It's the same old, right? So we've seen that there's been expectations of a horrific event that could happen. You know, name all the different things that can happen over the years, from various health issues to geopolitical issues to economic issues. And in the end, it's like nothing happens. And one of the things that was really interesting about this, it really cemented the whole idea that, the central banks are in charge. So running up into this, all the central banks were saying that, hey, don't worry if Brexit does occur, which we don't think it's going to. Well, we got your backs. We'll make sure there's plenty of liquidity. We'll make sure there's plenty of stimulus out there. Even the Bank of England came out with some commentary during and after that, hey, we're going to probably reduce rates, which they didn't, as we know. But meanwhile, stocks keep running higher, not only in the U.S., but around the world, which is really interesting. All-time highs on a variety of different indices. And I think one of the things that really was, I think, probably the most interesting of all this was, you know, the question of why. And the only answer that I can come up with that makes any sense is that the central banks decided, well, we're going to flush the system with liquidity any way that we can. We're going to talk it up. We're going to possibly reduce rates. We're going to hold off on any kind of rate increases into the future. And when the realization after Brexit occurred that, well, number one, while it was a referendum, the potential for it to being reversed is there. Number two, if it does go through, it's going to take a minimum of 2 to 5 years to actually occur. And we're not going to see a lot of the things right now. Now, add that to the fact that you have all this liquidity in there and all this central bank largesse and promises. And what you have is now an overheated situation where you have ultra stimulus and nothing happening, a non-event, or a non-event at least in the time being. So why not just take your shot at throwing money into stocks, regardless of valuations, regardless of really what's going to happen long term? Because over the short term, really, there's going to be nothing that's going to be affecting things, at least for, let's say, 3 to 6 months at a minimum.
All right, we are into earnings season here. So far, you know, not too bad. A couple misses, a couple beats here. But overall, prevailing sentiment is companies are beating lowered expectations here. Give us your appraisal of the earnings season so far and what you're looking for the remainder.
So we did see Goldman Sachs out today. I mean, estimates were lowered down to $3. They beat it handily. However, if you look back at several months and look at what the analysts were expecting back then, it was about 365, 366. So the beat they had on earnings was really on, as you mentioned, very low expectations. That is the game that analysts play, right? We lower the bar low enough in coordination with conversations with the company itself, looking at guidance, and then we have a beat. And unfortunately, one of the problems we have is that many investors just look at the beat to miss ratio, which is usually about 70% or so, right? About 70% of stocks usually kind of beat expectations on a quarterly basis. However, the fact is that when we look at it in a different manner, we look at what's the earnings growth rate, how are earnings overall coming in over time, we see that this is probably going to be the fifth consecutive quarter of lowered overall earnings on the S&P 500. So the outlook right now is about $113 on an overall basis for the S&P 500 in the composite in terms of earnings for this quarter coming up. Well, that takes us to about 19.5 forward PE on where we are now, or on the current plus the forward, this current quarter, which we don't know at this point what happens at the end, which is towards the high range of PE. Now, that's not the only thing you want to look for. You want to look at other things like PEG ratios and price to book. Almost every metric that you look at, we're seeing that we have a very highly valued market right now, highly valued from a current level and from a historic level. Even look at the things like the Shiller index of earnings estimates, and that's out of whack too. He's a 10-month moving average, 10-year moving average. But you know what? You look at all of this and you combine it, you say, well, why are markets still going higher? It's back to my discussion of what happened post-Brexit, that there is an incredible amount of, well, just I guess a look that, well, we're just going to get money for free, helicopter money. We're talking about perpetual bonds in Japan. We're talking about China, you know, doing what they can to push money in. Europe, of course, the ECB saying that they're going to continue to move money into the markets, and the U.S. saying, well, we're going to hold off, even though our inflation target has been met, essentially, and our employment target has been met. Right now, everybody is realizing very clearly that the central banks are much more focused on markets rather than they are focused on economics. And finally, just one other point, when it comes to buybacks, which has been a big part of this move of the markets, the last couple of weeks we've seen historic levels of buybacks by companies. One of the big reasons is that interest rates are so low, companies can borrow money, push it into their coffers, if you will, buy back shares, issue higher dividends, which is everything that investors want to see. So we're kind of in a, I hate to use the phrase, but a bit of a Goldilocks scenario right now.
And if you look at valuations and you say, oh, you know, the S&Ps are trading 18, 19 times the earnings here. And if you're sitting there waiting for it to come in, you know, back to, you know, historical low levels, 12, 13, 14, I mean, you may be waiting a long time because it could easily go to 22, 23, and then 19 is not going to look so bad.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that the if you want to really get a level that seems reasonable, not to the low end if in recessionary times, not as the ultra high. I mean, if you think about just the 17.5, which is, I mean, 17.5 PE is not abnormal numbers. Matter of fact, we could probably say historically it's a little bit on the high end. But if you look at 17.5, looking at $113 of earnings, we're talking about a target somewhere of about 1975 on the S&P 500.
And we're quite a bit above that now.
Oh, yeah.
Moving on here. We don't talk a whole lot about portfolio allocation here with respect to stocks, bonds, fixed income, and commodities here. Just talk about your asset allocation now with regard to bonds and fixed income.
So one of the things we've done over the last couple of years is look at the universe of bonds and said that, well, you know what, we want to kind of continue to shorten up the maturities and durations. Now, when you look at that and you say, well, 2, maybe even 3 years back, that would be a good idea. Well, it did seem like a good idea. Meanwhile, bonds have been continuing to move higher and yields continuing to move lower over that period of time. However, when you look at the duration risk and maturity risk on whether it's an ETF, whether it's a bond mutual fund or individual bonds, and you look at skew and a variety of other statistical references in terms of how bonds can perform in different times, I think the most important thing here is that you didn't get a lot of differential in terms of if you shortened up to the mid part of the curve compared to the long end or the short end. So by us continuing to shorten down over time the level of maturities and duration, we actually got a really good return in our global allocation portfolios from the fixed income component, which is a combination of domestic and international, as well as very short term. We have some very short term positions in there. Those have done very, very well and added a tremendous amount. And what's interesting is that what you usually don't see is that bonds and stocks move in tandem. Right now, over the last several months, we've seen that happen. We've seen that bonds have gone, yields have gone lower, prices have gone higher, stocks have gone higher. Well, what does that tell us? That tells us that there is an incredible search for yield. We just did a study, as a matter of fact, looking at the differential in returns between the highest yielding S&P 500 stocks and the lowest yielding S&P 500 stocks. We looked at it currently over the last year and then also historically. And a lot of times you could look at those as value versus growth plays as well. But even the growth plays these days, you know, are issuing dividends. Well, what we found was what we kind of expected was that there is a significant outperformance of the higher yielding stocks in the universe of the S&P 500. And if you think about that, it makes a lot of sense because what's happening around the world? Well, you have negative interest rates in Japan. You have negative interest rates in Europe. And very low, ultra low interest rates everywhere else. Well, what you could do is a quick arbitrage of just simply selling bonds and buying stocks, or if nothing else, borrowing money at very low interest rates, borrow at 1% and get a 4% or a 3% return on a stock or a basket of stocks. And by doing so, with the understanding that the Fed has provided a level of a safety net, if you will, underneath stocks, well, there's not much risk. However, the fact still remains that there's a tremendous amount of risk in doing that because at any given time, that 3% or 4% yield can be eaten up by a simple drop in the stock. But the other problem is that there's really nowhere else to go. I got an email yesterday. An email was, hey, Andrew, just wondering, I have $50,000 in a Bank of America account, and that Bank of America account is yielding, what, 0.02 or 0.1, right? What do I do? Where can I go to have safety and liquidity? And you know what my answer was, right?
Keep it in the
nowhere.
Bank.
there's nowhere to go. Where are you going to go? So the problem is that investors are being pushed into alternatives where you have the senior citizen who was at one time reliant on their bank account to pay for their groceries, their movies, their various expenses over and above maybe their pension and their Social Security income. They don't have that anymore. That's a tremendous amount of income that now is destroyed and that is not able to be replaced. So they have to look for alternatives. That's why the number one sector in the S&P this year is the utility sector. I mean, the utilities are up what? They're up 20, the utility ETF this year is up 20.5%.
Yeah, unbelievable. So I think that tells, Before I let you go, Andrew, we got 1 minute left here. Everyone has different indicators that they like to look at for the market. And you have a couple, and you want, what are they saying about the markets here? You got the KRI and the Spearman. Touch on those for us before we let you go.
All right, real quick, the KRI is a an indicator that we built based on a variety of different sentiment and trending levels. And basically, it's called the key reversal indicator. It hit a plus five a couple of days ago. It's currently at a plus two or plus three right now. Plus seven is kind of get the hell out of Dodge. Plus five, plus six is pay worry. The Spearman is also topping out right here. Usually when the Spearman tops out, it's a plus 97 right now. It's a great statistical calculation of trend levels and exhaustion levels. So right now, we are seeing a very high level of overbought situation, which, again, is no mystery, I don't think, to anybody. But it's clearly showing up in the indicators as well.
Andrew Horowitz, CPF of Horowitz & Company, giving us a good fundamental outlook on the markets. Thanks a lot, Andrew. We'll hope to talk to you again soon.
All right, Joel, have a great day. Have a great trading day.
Yep. All right, our next guest is Miles Klein, portfolio manager and founder of the Ticuda Group. We'll be right back. Welcome back, traders and investors, to Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep, brought to you by Benzinga Pro. I'm your co-host, Joel Elkanen, along with Spencer Israel and Dylan Wittenberg, and we have a special guest on the line. That's Miles Klein, portfolio manager and founder of the Ticuda Group. Miles, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Joel. How are you?
We're doing good. So tell us, give us a little bit of your background in the markets and why you founded Ticuda Group, and what do you offer to clients, individuals, or corporations?
Wow, what do I got, like an hour here?
Yeah.
So we're kind of different because we don't do the traditional type of asset management that most institutions would do. If we could see the deck that I sent you, you know, I snipped a little piece out of one of our competitors, one of our big competitors, the banks in Canada, who represent about 70% of our market up here. And, you know, typically the ordinary asset allocation model is where they design you see the pie charts going from conservative to aggressive, and you get a fixed asset allocation. And, you know, one of the charts that I had showed exactly that, and, you know, where the aggressive allocation was 35% U.S. equities, 35% Canadian equities, and 30% international equities. And the challenge that I have with that is that, you know, traditional rebalancing would have you no less than once a year bring that model back into, you know, the similar type asset allocation fix. And, you know, if we look back just 5 years in the market here, The Canadian index has generated about 1.83% compound rate of return. MSCI EAFE has generated about 8%, and the U.S. S&P 500 has generated about 15.75. And so, over that time frame, had you had that asset allocation that many of these institutions would have subscribed that you would have, you would have had one asset class doing the heavy lifting and a number of the asset classes probably actually losing some capital and some of them somewhere in between. And then during the course of that last 5 years, they had strongly recommended, or they would have done it automatically for you, to rebalance that portfolio, taking from your winners and giving to your losers. And so all the work that we do, you know, validates the fact that, you know, we don't adhere to a fixed asset allocation for our clients, even though our industry would strongly recommend that, simply because, you know, our focus is identifying the sectors of the market that are the strongest, and that's where we should be allocating the majority of our capital.
All right. Let's move on here. You help people plan for their retirement. One of your slides here was the power of 1% in your retirement. Did you talk about the start of the annual withdrawals to the end? Explain that to us.
Yeah, we're performance driven, and ironically in our industry, they say don't talk too much about performance because, you know, when you're not performing, then what have you got to say to people? Well, the reality is that if you're chronically underperforming, well, then you have a problem. But, we're performance driven. Everything we do, even if you have a conservative portfolio, we say let's have the best performing conservative portfolio as opposed to the worst, or somewhere in between. And the reality is this chart shows that, you know, if you started with $100,000 and you invested for 20 years, the value of your portfolio, if you could earn 1% more, just earning 6% versus 5%. And then, you know, the really important feature is that if you look out into your retirement then and you could keep earning that additional 1%, that 1% generates you almost a decade more of retirement income. And this is based on an initial $100,000 and then withdrawing $25,000 in retirement. So, you know, 1% can constitute an additional decade of income in retirement for you. And so the challenge is where do you find that 1%? And we found multiple places to find that 1%. And in a presentation that we do, we show the collective value of a number of factors that we kind of filter in the marketplace to keep generating additional 1%.
All right. Also, one of your diagrams here was showing your asset allocation here from very conservative to aggressive growth. How do you decide, you know, for people, is it based on their age, their income? What do you do?
Well, we leave that up to the client. One of the charts also that we have is one that shows, you know, there's two time frames in people's lives. There's your accumulation phase where you're saving your capital, and then there's a time in your life where you're drawing on that capital for your additional income that you need for whatever reason, whether that's retirement or, you know, predominantly retirement, or maybe there's some other factor in your life why you need to draw your income down. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, traditionally our industry would tell you that the older you get, the more conservative you should become. And, you know, we all know the challenges with bonds in the environment right now. And, you know, they could conceivably become one of the biggest anchors for decades in people's portfolios. And our industry would have you, the older you get, put more money into that asset and maintain that amount of capital in those lesser performing asset classes. And so we won't tell a person what they have to do when we sit down with them. We have a variety of different, we refer to them as sub-models, and each sub-model may be a specific, you know, area of the market or type of investing. And what we do is we build a portfolio out of our own sub-models for clients, and then what we do is we illustrate for them exactly going back as far as 2008, so that they can see what the performance would have looked like relative to a fair benchmark of that particular investment.
All right. And you also sent us a chart here, fixed allocation that rebalances has issues. And you're just going real short. You're going total returns as of July 15, 2006. Talk about the other components that you have in there and how the rebalancing has issues.
Yeah, you know, mentioned this a little bit earlier, is that rebalancing has two major issues. One, they keep you, when you have a fixed asset allocation, you're stuck inside sectors of the market that will underperform. And I mean, that's part of having a fixed asset allocation. Part of the argument for having that is that, you know, our industry says, well, you never know when one asset class is going to outperform another, but just own a whole bunch of asset classes and get the average performance of all of them. You know, I don't buy that argument because it's just too weak, and the results and the consequences of that behavior are too negative. And, you know, one of the biggest drawbacks of that also is that, you know, investment cycles are, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7, 8, 10 years in length. And when you have an asset allocation model that continually rebalances, and our industry will typically do this no less than once a year. And I often see, you know, institutions saying, well, we do this every month. And our research has shown that the more frequently you rebalance, the more negative impact there is to a portfolio, simply because you're taking from the asset classes that are performing and you're reallocating assets to sectors of your portfolio that are underperforming and probably will continue to underperform for years. So eventually, you're right, you make the one good asset allocation decision of where you sell something and buy something else where it's actually intelligent. But meanwhile, for the previous 7 to 10 years, you've been, you know, making mistakes by doing that and hurting the portfolio and its performance.
Another thing that hurts portfolio performance is, you know, these big dips in the market, the risk and the recovery. What can happen when you don't consider the recovery factor?
Yeah, that's kind of the third part of our analysis. We measure, you know, three factors. Most people are familiar with the concept of, you know, hey, you should buy this investment. And the two immediate questions people ask, well, how much could I make and how much could I lose? And the third factor is the recovery cycle on that. And I had included a graph of this and where we had two investments and they're both, you know, over quite a few years, they're both kind of following the same trajectory, have a similar level of risk and growth. And then one investment breaks down and it's not recovering, whereas the other investment breaks down and then it recovers very aggressively and continues on its own way. And what we look at when we look at any strategy that we build, we measure the risk return and the recovery of that. And then what we do is we correlate that with any other strategy that we're looking to put together. So, you know, we have a good sense of how effective an investment strategy is when we build it into our portfolio in terms of how much you're going to make, how much you could potentially have at risk during market corrections, and then how quickly that investment strategy recovers. A good example, and I don't have a chart of this, is an equity strategy that we run in Canada here, where in 2008-09, when the market melted down globally, our markets, U.S. markets, they all dropped about 50%. Our strategy dropped about 25%, so we were far from perfect, but we recovered from the bottom in 5 months, and in fact, the Canadian market still hasn't recovered more than 8.5 years later. So if we ignore the recovery factor when we look at our strategies, then we ignore we miss a big part of what we should be looking at.
All right, and finally, does size matter? You're talking about the compounded rate of return, 12.2% versus 5.5. I assume this goes to the asset allocation.
Yeah, well, this talk about when we look at identifying the types of investment strategies, if you're buying predominantly like mutual funds in our industries, is that, you know, size does matter. And you know, you could argue that often, particularly on the fixed income side, bigger is better because you get a lot more economy of scale, you get the deal flow better. But on the equity side, when you're playing in the marketplace, this example I show is two Canadian equity funds. One's generated, as you mentioned, the 12.2%. The other one's generated a 5.5% rate of return. The one that generated 5.5% rate of return is a very popular bank-offered Canadian mutual fund. It's got over $15 billion in assets in it, whereas the other one is a private fund company. It's got about $1.2 billion in it, and, you know, it's generated more than double the returns of the larger fund. So when we look at investments, you know, it stands to reason that the larger the investment is, the more diversified it's going to have to be just to avoid concentration in the marketplace. And so over time, you know, often success begets failure simply because of size in our industry, and investment strategies begin looking more and more like the market. And when we compare the returns of these to the market, you know, often they're very similar, and they just don't have the opportunity to take advantage of, you know, different anomalies in the marketplace that will add value.
Miles Klein, portfolio manager and founder of the Tycuda Group, talking asset allocation here. Thanks a lot for coming on, Miles. Sorry about the charts. We'll get them up there for you next time. Have a great day.
Thanks, Joel. You also.
All right, S&P futures are open. We've been real quiet here, just around the 2155 level, mid-range on the day right there, 2156, all-time closing high. Up there at 2160 and a quarter, your pre-market highs right there, 2160.75. Spencer, what do we got on tap for tomorrow?
Looking at tomorrow's show, it is Wednesday, so we'll have Tommy Lackey Jr. on the show. Also going to have Andrew Moss. He is a wealth management advisor and senior vice president at Merrill Lynch. And then, of course, Tim Melvin will be on the show, Market Time Maven, and author of Tim Melvin, Deep Value Letter. So looking forward to those guests tomorrow. We're going to let you go. Hope you have a good rest of your day, and we will see you guys tomorrow.